Next Thursday is the end of the state legislative session. It is the do or die deadlines for all the ideas that have gone to Sacramento, hoping to make their way into state law. And the bills that are still in play include a whole slew of measures that aspire to change the way the state of California does criminal sentencing and governs police conduct. There are bills in play that would do everything from change the circumstances under which police are allowed to use deadly force, that would keep kids out of adult courts, that would change sentencing standards for people who have been convicted, and that would change the way bail is determined before people have even been convicted of a crime. We are joined in studio by someone who keeps her eye on every single one of those bills as part of her job. Emily Harris is a senior campaigner with the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. Based in Oakland, she spends a lot of her time in the Capitol. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Where are you putting most of your time right now?
I have been doing a significant amount of work on Senator Mitchell and Senator Lara's bill package. It's the Equity and Justice package. This is the second year they've run a package of bills that are looking to reform both the juvenile and criminal justice system. We had some significant wins last year, and we've been building on that momentum. The Ella Baker Center is one of the co-sponsors on the Fair and Just Sentencing Reform Act of 2018, which is SB 1393. And the bill just made it out of the Appropriations Committee last week, and we're headed to the Assembly floor. And this bill would provide, we'd go back to providing judicial discretion for a sentence enhancement. So in California, we have over 100 sentence enhancements, which are added on top of somebody's base term for a variety of things. And these ones are for prior serious convictions. So currently it's mandatory that if you have a prior serious conviction, you get 5 years added on to your sentence. And we want to be able to restore judicial discretion so that a judge has the opportunity to choose if in the interest of justice at sentencing, a five-year enhancement makes sense to add onto somebody's sentence.
So the Appropriations Committee has the reputation of being the place good bills go to die. Do you feel like that was your most serious hurdle and you've cleared it?
Well, luckily, with a lot of the good criminal justice reform efforts that we're working on, they're actually going to reduce the cost of prisons in our state. You know, we have an outrageous budget for incarceration, but this bill and many of the bills we've worked on will save the state thousands and thousands of dollars and hopefully be able to bring back all of the individuals who are serving time in out-of-state prisons, which has been one of the most costly parts of our corrections and budget at the moment. And so luckily, you know, we flew through appropriations on the Senate side, and we're pretty successful last week as well.
Until very recently, there was a almost undefeatable law enforcement lobby in the state capitol representing associations of jail guards, sheriff's deputies, police officers, tough on crime prosecutors, all of whom were willing to tar their opponents as being soft on crime and putting public safety at risk. And it just seems to have melted away. What do you think accounts for this shift in state politics?
Well, I would say they are still incredibly powerful. I wish the idea of melted away was a reality for us. But I do think that specifically under the leadership of Governor Brown, we have seen really significant reforms. And I think there's also been a shift in cultural consciousness around the idea that locking people up and sending them away and keeping them in cages away from their families for a long time doesn't actually result in longer term healthier, sustainable, safer communities. And I think that the policies are following that consciousness. And I believe also that we've seen a significant change in the, you know, the movement around ending mass incarceration and mass criminalization. And those folks who've been incarcerated, family members, sharing their stories, coming up to the legislature. I've been in California for about 11 years doing policy work, and I would say in the last 5 years, one of the significant shifts that we've seen is families and loved ones and people who've been locked up coming to the Capitol and really talking to lawmakers about their experiences and helping to shift the understanding around, you know, what had been sort of these tough on crime, this is the only way, and really helping folks think more about how to be smart and strategic and to build safer communities. And so I think that our organizations and our movement is way less resourced than the, you know, the lobbies that you were talking about, and they're still all over the Capitol. But I think that when we really look at the human impact, I think that folks want to do what's right. And I think that we still have an incredibly long way to go when we're looking at mass incarceration in California. The reforms that we've had have been significant, but they've also been minor compared to all of the tough on crime policies of the 80s that have got us into this mess in the first place.
Talk about the budget savings, because obviously for Governor Brown, budget has been a guiding light in his policy decisions. So you are saying it makes sense that if people are not automatically kept in jail for an extra 5 years, that we're going to save 5 years worth of expenses of putting them up in jail. Talk more about the nature of this shift in perception on incarceration based on budget considerations.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we've seen in the last several years under the Plata-Coleman ruling around overcrowding in the state prison, in the state prisons where we've been mandated to reduce the prison population, we've seen some really strong reforms like Prop 47, Prop 57, and others that are starting to reduce the number of people locked up. But we haven't actually seen subsequent savings. And part of that is because we have the same amount of capacity and even more capacity, that meaning like the number of beds, prisons that exist in the state. And in order to really significantly save in our state, we actually need to start shutting down prisons. And in terms of the savings that can be achieved right now based on the reforms that we're talking about, like the Fair and Just Sentencing Reform Act, those numbers will specifically come, and those reductions will come from the cost of sending people to out-of-state prisons. So we have folks in out-of-state private facilities very, very far away from their families and loved ones. And I think at the peak, we had up to 8 or 10,000 individuals in out-of-state prisons, and that number has reduced significantly, but it's a disproportionately higher cost per person to be locked up than in the state of California.
So I want to drill down on this too. I mean, as we have started incarcerating fewer people and reducing overcrowding in the prisons, the cost per inmate of keeping people locked up has gone up.
Yes.
Because of exactly what you described. Same amount of guards, same amount of prison staff, fewer inmates to meet the terms of a court order. The estimate is now $70,000 per prisoner per year to keep someone locked up in California. If those numbers don't substantially budge until California starts shutting prisons, how far is this state from drawing down its incarcerated population enough that it can do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really it depends on the reforms that we move in order to be able to do that. I think that this year in particular, with it being the governor's last year in office and with his commitment to shifting the policies that he was partly responsible for putting in place, we're seeing that those numbers can continue to come down, but it's actually really we're talking about like what implementation looks like. And we've seen other types of policies in addition to the legislative work. We're seeing just last week, the governor commuted a significant number of people serving incredibly long sentences. We've seen other types of, you know, ballot initiatives. But I think that we're also seeing the law enforcement lobby that you mentioned earlier fearing the idea that communities are going to continue to reclaim our power, and therefore the resources that are part of locking away our folks, and are emboldening. So the law enforcement lobby has been pushing to reverse a lot of the reforms, the really significant reforms that we've seen that are also just a fraction of what we need. And so I think that it's really going to play out in the next administration where we can go in terms of the possibility of getting to the place where we can, you know, close a violent, dangerous prison like Pelican Bay that has cost our state significant amount of resources. And I think it's going to require a continued leadership from our legislators. And I think that they have started to see that in order to see the savings that they've they've promised that we're going to actually have to really shift the capacity in our state.
Right. But like specifically, what's in play now? Taking off sentencing enhancements for people with prior records, returning discretion where previously judges were banned by, bound by mandatory sentencing requirements. You're saying that might be enough to get some people out of state prisons where we pay per head, but not to shut down facilities in California. How dramatic a sentencing reform would we need to be at the place where we are shutting down mm-hmm. a facility like Pelican Bay?
Well, I think it would take a series more legislation. So we're going to have to look at extreme sentences. So, for example, 1393 looks at one of over 100 enhancements.
This is the one that returns discretion in sentencing.
Exactly. And ideally, we would be repealing that enhancement, but it was put in place by voters, so it's really hard to get rid of through the legislature. But we need to be looking at other types of extreme sentencing, like life without the possibility of parole that keeps people in prison for decades and decades, or looking at the three strikes law and really looking at the long, long, long sentences that we're sending people to prison for, and also looking at one of the other bills that we're working on, SB 1391, which is looking at trying to stop 14 and 15-year-olds from being sentenced through the adult court system. We're also seeing a significant number of incredibly young people being sentenced for 200 to life sentences. And so if we don't look at the extreme sentencing and really reduce the amount of time we're sending people away, and we know that extreme sentencing and long sentences isn't actually a deterrent for crime, it's not reducing the issues that were claimed to be put in place for. So we're going to have to really, really look at sentencing and look at it in a comprehensive way. So right now we're doing small piecemeal shifts, but we're going to have to do a whole lot more to be able to.
And this, the sentences, the requirements that are binding judges, these were mostly put in place in the 80s, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so we're still suffering the consequences of that tightening that was done in the 1980s.
Yeah, and some of it was put in place by voters, right? Like the Three Strikes Initiative, and then other pieces were put in place by the legislature. One of the other important sentencing reforms that's happening this year is by Senator Skinner. It's 1437, and it's a bill to look at the felony murder rule. That's one of the kinds of laws that has resulted in significant numbers of people being incarcerated, particularly young people or domestic violence survivors. And basically, in the commission of a felony, if anybody dies, everybody who was present can be charged with murder. So even if you weren't the person who perpetrated the murder, if you were the getaway driver, we're seeing, the way sentencing has worked, it just is a huge umbrella, and it brings in so many people.
This one is also sometimes referred to as the girlfriend rule. Is that right? Because many people who it's the girlfriend of the perpetrator are sitting there, and they're also then sentenced,
yes,
as committing
mm-hmm.
a felony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and many of them are serving life without the possibility of parole.
Speaking of Emily Harris, she is a senior campaigner with the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights based in Oakland. She spends most of her time in Sacramento, where she is among many, many criminal justice reformers who are trying to shepherd through before the end of the state legislative session next week a slew of measures that would change how sentencing works and also constraints on the activities of police. I want to spend a minute on some of those because these are some big ticket items. AB 931 is a bill that would effectively, as I understand it, get rid of stand your ground for police officers. It would place more restraints on their ability to use deadly force when they have alternatives like putting time and distance between themselves and someone who might otherwise present a threat. What's the pushback look like on that bill?
Well, I think, we haven't seen, as we were talking about there, we've seen a significant shift in criminal justice reforms over the last few years. But I think in terms of the reforms around policing, that is actually, despite national headlines and significant, incredible organizing by groups like Movement for Black Lives, the issue around police violence is at the center of the media, but it hasn't been at the center of the legislature. And this year, Dr. Weber's bill, AB 931 and SB 1421 by Senator Skinner, are some of the first really robust reforms around policing. And I think that I think what we see is a concern from law enforcement of having their power taken away, and wanting to be able to make, you know, the choices in the spur of the moment. And we know that in other states where the stand your ground rules have been shifted, or in some of the jurisdictions that have shifted, we've also seen a decline in the use of deadly force, and also a decline in the, you know, injuries or deaths that police officers have experienced. So I think changing the rules around excessive force makes it so that, you know, law enforcement is less likely to jump to a more violent outcome.
You're saying
outcome.
Making it harder for cops to get away with shooting people saves cops' lives too?
It does, yeah.
Bill, does the bill also include de-escalation training, or is there already de-escalation training for police officers in our state?
I'm not sure if the bill specifically talks about, includes a provision around de-escalation training, but that is one of the pieces that, you know, we have advocated for, wanting to make sure that there is a wider range of strategies that are being used when somebody is being called into a scene of a crime.
And there's been some controversy over another push on the criminal reform tip, which is there's been a big push to get rid of the cash bail system, which obviously is a system that is incredibly biased against people without cash, many of whom may spend months incarcerated on charges that they intend to fight and may never stick. The bill that has been seeking to reform this, Senate Bill 10, has been amended into such a state that it would place vast restrictions on the use of cash bail, but it would change the criteria to something called risk assessments that are somewhat controversial. Your organization's now taken a neutral stance on the bill. Can you kind of explain the controversy?
Mm-hmm. So there has been a large campaign over the last several years, SB 10 by Senator Hertzberg and AB 42 by Assemblymember Bonta, to really look at the disproportionate length of time that people are serving pretrial, and particularly at money bail. The legislation took a recent shift, and based on where it is, the Ella Baker Center is no longer in support. But I see that there are both positives and concerns about the bill, and there's definitely stakeholders on all sides. I think particularly the elimination of the commercial bail industry is incredibly important in terms of its, you know, predatory exploitation of poor people in our state. However, I think the current model is not the model of pre-trial justice and racial equity that we need in our state. And the Ella Baker Center also recognizes that, you know, one bill is not going to be the silver bullet for the reforms that we need, and that we're going to have to continue to work with the legislature. I think particularly in the current proposal shifts the power of judges to have a significant ability based on the risk assessments to choose who is able to be detained. And we're not sure that this new proposal would reduce the number of people pretrial. And that's actually the underlying issue. You know, the bail industry is taking advantage of the fact that people are being detained even when they haven't been, you know, convicted of a crime. They're being held for a long time pretrial, and they're an out, right? They're an out so that folks are able to get home to their children. They're able to stay in their jobs. They're not going to lose their homes. But the actual underlying issue is around people being detained pretrial. And we're not sure that the current bill would reduce those numbers. And so we want to continue to work with the legislature and leadership in the state to make sure that bail reform actually looks what our communities need.
Why? What's potentially bad about risk assessments in lieu of cash bail?
Well, I think significant in the original version of SB 10 would have more elements where we could look at racial bias in the risk assessments. We would do data collection and be able to really track and have community input on which of the risk assessment tools were used. And some of those have shifted in the current policy. And then in terms of when risk is determined, there's a couple of ways that can be looked at. So it could be about whether it's your failure to appear at court versus your risk of being a harm to another individual. And we're concerned about those things being conflated, where I think if we look at what folks, when folks are not returning to court, there's a lot of services that people need. And that was the original reason why the Ella Baker Center got involved, was wanting to have robust services around pretrial release that would be supporting communities being able to get a bus pass if they needed to get back to court, to get reminder phone calls, as opposed to having a surveillance system where somebody has an ankle monitor or is being held in a cell until they're able to return to court.
Emily Harris, finally, I wanted to kind of follow up on the tip from our last interview. California is starting to draw down its prison population. It's releasing people who have been locked up in some cases for decades at a time. There seems to be a dearth of services to support that reentry process, particularly for people whose criminal history makes them ineligible for a broad swath of jobs, access to public housing, and other safety net programs. Who's working that end of the problem?
Yeah, there are a number of great organizations, All of Us or None, and many who have been really looking at ban the box policies. So looking at the policies that are excluding people from participating. And I do think as folks are returning home, we're starting to acknowledge that there is a dearth of services for people. But that has to be part of, as the state is looking at where we put our money and looking at, you know, so our budget as a moral document, we need to be further resourcing housing for folks who are coming home and actually having programs that are more specific to the individual needs of folks. So for example, I've worked a lot with people who are incarcerated who are transgender, and there's not a lot of housing that is specifically able to support individuals who are trans when they return home. And we need to be able to have programs that are led by people who have lived those experiences, right? It's a, you know, a two for one, right? We can employ people who have been there to be able to be the next round of folks supporting people who are returning home. So there are some models, but we need to be putting a lot more state dollars there.
But it seems like it's a fundamental political problem for the work you're doing, because the success of the sentencing reforms that are being implemented now is going to be judged in part by the recidivism rate of the people who are released. And if there are people who are being released into a state of affairs where they have almost no options for supporting themselves that aren't in the black market because of the way we stigmatize ex-offenders, that is going to make it harder to get further reforms in the future.
I think that's right. Although I think that the way that we think about recidivism is also, I would say that recidivism rates aren't necessarily particularly related to whether or not somebody is being convicted of a new crime. I think there's a lot of like regulations and limitations that are put on people that result in them being sent back to prison. And we've seen the recidivism rate shift based on realignment or like which jurisdiction is going to be responsible for paying to house people. And so I do think that you're right. And part of the reason why the Ella Baker Center, one of our visions is around truth and reinvestment and really pushing to reinvest the resources saved by ending mass incarceration into the communities that need them most.
Emily Harris, thank you so much. Emily Harris is a senior campaigner with the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. The package of bills that she is working on regarding sentencing reform are titled SB 1391, 1392, 1393. The deadline for passage of all bills in the Capitol is next Thursday.